David, you are unquestionably the one at the table with the most experience flying in this area, although Dave Hirschman is going to be a very close second. So let me start with you. There are a bunch of things you brought up. There's not much weather reporting. There is the uncertainty of a small difference in headwind, tailwind could make a big difference in whether you make it to your fuel stop or not. There are points of no return. And then there's if you have a mechanical problem and suddenly have to put down, some of this area is so rugged, there's just no place to go. What is the biggest thing that someone new to this area should have to think about?
Well, I got a one-word answer for you, and it's all of the above. Or three-word answer, I guess, all of the above. All of these choices are reasonable. Like, there's no real showstoppers there. And so it all boils down to threat and error management. It's very, very important that you evaluate what threats, and you elucidated the three biggies. And so the question is, how do you apply them to each route? And it generally has to do with visibility. I've done a lot of zooming along pretty low. And as long as I can see where I'm going, I'm happy. But when you start getting rain events, or you start getting mist, which is common on the coast, or the low strata ceilings, that's when you need to really have a plan, a way to turn back that's viable, both weather and fuel. And then finally, with terrain, I've had three engine failures in small piston airplanes, one in a single, two in a twin, and two partials over 40 years. And so I don't obsess about the engine failing, but I do acknowledge it as a possibility. And so really nasty terrain, like that bit from Dease Lake to Juneau, that's bad. Like, they're not going to find you when you splat down. Or some hunter will find you your skeleton 30 years later. So I think the idea that you maintain an ability to reach landable terrain, ideally as much as possible, understanding that there may be times when you give that up. But if you have a choice between following a road, being near settlements, or being in untracked wilderness, I'm going to lean towards that. I think when you look at low-time pilots coming to grief, it's almost always because they did not think about what the threats were and did not have pre-planned options. And then they got into a position where they ran out of choices and it ended badly.
And risk tolerance is what underlies this whole scenario. And it comes up again and again and again around this table because it underlies kind of what we do aviation-wise. I mean, there are obviously times when if the engine fails now or something goes wrong now, it's just bad. There's going to be no way to deal with it. And we accept that to a certain amount. It sounds like what you're saying is you want to keep as many options open for that. Dave, you're on the other side of this with going direct into the headwind, overflying Canada, not a lot of options or any if you have a need to put down somewhere along the coastline. And this isn't theoretical for you. You've done all these trips. Like, you really understand what's there. Why does option one make sense within the risk tolerance matrix that you have and might suggest to this pilot?
Yeah, a couple of reasons. First, from David's risk assessment, to me, the biggest risk is mountain weather. I don't want any part of that on this. And then from the reward standpoint, this pilot has got a rare opportunity to fly the Alaska coast in good weather in the summertime, which doesn't happen all that often. It's usually rainy and dreary and fairly low visibility. So, the opportunity to do this is fairly rare. And you, from looking at it from the scenario pilot's perspective, this guy's in search of adventure. And it's like, this is a lifetime thing for a GA pilot, is to fly that Alaska route, in the coastal route to Alaska, in good weather. Doesn't happen very often, but it's an experience that pilot will never forget. You go by, Glacier Bay and Mount Fairweather and Wrangell National Forest, and it's incomparable. It's one of the greatest places to fly that I'm aware of on Earth. So it's like, this pilot is perfectly situated for it. He's got a plane that'll do it. He's got the weather. He's got the reasons to want to do it. And the two items that I would recommend, that David touched on one of them, is a fuel bladder. You know, bring a fuel bladder, 10 gallons, maybe 20 gallons of extra fuel in the back of the plane if you have to land, and a passport. You know, if you bring your passport and a fuel bladder, they are equipped to deal with a pilot who diverts for weather or mechanical reasons. It's not going to cause an international incident. So I would say to this pilot, man, you've got the situation has lined up in your favor. The variables are backing you except for the wind. Go for it. You may want to reduce the power to 55% to save some gas. You know, bring a passport and some extra fuel if you're really in a bind. But this is a once in a lifetime trip. Go for it and avoid the smoke, the turbulence, the poor weather in the mountains, and the straight up boringness of the highway route. And go have this experience that you'll always treasure.
Right. So if you're going to have the adventure, be all chips in on adventure, and hope that, you know, as you're flying, enjoying that spectacular view, it's your nerves about the little sounds the engine makes are not going to undermine the beauty of the view.
You are Apollo 8 going by the dark side of the moon. I mean, it's like you are going to be out of reach at certain points. And, the idea of rescue is remote. You know, I mean, if you're going down in that cold water in Glacier Bay,
you're done.
Yeah. But it's so. Like, hey, that's, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound. If you wanted the adventure, this is what it takes.
Paul.
Sorry. You snatched victory from the jaws of defeat there with the fuel bladder. I mean, when I looked at that scenario number one, I just saw complete insanity, because it has no options. It depends entirely on a single engine airplane with a light coming, no less. And I mean, I agree with you. I would love to do that route, but I would like to do it with something substantially more robust than a 172 with a little more fuel range. Two engines would be nice, and enough to carry some survival gear like a raft and maybe an immersion suit or something like that. Because otherwise, in the 172 without the fuel bladder, you got zero options. It's do or die shooting down that coast with only, what, not even an hour of reserve or barely an hour of reserve fuel. That seems really risky to me. I do get a risk profile of people willing to do that. But for this guy with very little experience and his first shot in Alaska flying along that coast, it just seems insane to me.
Well, the fuel bladder, it's a great point that was brought up, but just I want to follow up on that with either of the Davids here. You're talking about landing somewhere at an airport and refueling yourself, or are you talking about potentially landing off airport? You know, on a road somewhere and refueling yourself? Because if you did option two, fuel's not an issue. That takes fuel off the table, but you're still going up the coastline. It just takes a little bit longer to do. So with these fuel bladders, are you talking about if I didn't quite make it, I could land at Port Hardy, I think it is, kind of that airport that's not going to have fuel?
There are non-towered airports along the way where you can stop, put the fuel in, resume your trip. This is one of the seaplane pilot tricks that do this route. They carry fuel in the floats. They land along the way. They put the fuel in the tanks. They resume their trip. It's all VFR. It's all non-radar environment. You know, nobody knows or cares.
The point is still you're being exposed out there on the coastline versus the mountain weather or the even lower weather, but it's going to be over the plains to the east. Catherine, you seem to be split between the coast, and I know you're stopping for gas because we know how you are about gas. I get that. Or you're going all the way around on the most boring route through marginal VFR weather the whole way, but at least it's over a prairie so you can turn around What's the thinking there? And if you were this pilot that morning, like, how would you decide? And I know you haven't flown up here like most of us haven't. So it's a good question there.
Right. Yeah. For me, this is a bucket list item. But I'm with Dave. I'm going on the coast. You know, it's all about managing risk versus reward. And to me, flying up the coast would be an enormous reward. The weather is predicted to be the best along those routes. And I've mitigated the issue with fuel. To me, one is a non-starter because, as you mentioned, I have pretty robust fuel personal minimum. So to me, that solves that problem to go ahead and stop. You know, again, this is a chance of a lifetime. And, you know, I'm a 2/5, but I am heavily predisposed to number two. You know, I'll shout out to Nav Canada because they do have weather cameras. And part of the planning that could go into this trip is to be looking at forecasts and connecting that with what you're seeing in, you know, the weather cameras along the way. You know, there's a great website where you can go ahead and click in real time and get, you know, the cameras showing the current weather. But yeah, I'm going to go up the coast. It's going to be gorgeous and, you know, have a great reward.
So our meteorologist here at the table is taking the most inland route. JP, is that because you're more comfortable with dealing with weather uncertainty than forced landing uncertainty? Or is it something you're seeing in this weather pattern that you think is just more manageable? Or is it simply where you just personally feel more comfortable? Why the inland, most inland route?
I think for a lack of better terms, I'm a chicken. I love the idea of going up the coast, and I think that would be awesome. But I think I would choose to do that on a day where I had a little bit more capable equipment than that 172. And I've been in situations countless times where the winds are predicted one way. And in fact, coming up to pilot workshops one time, it took forever because the winds were about 30 knots in my face higher than what was predicted. And it puts myself in a fuel situation. Also, the situation from an aspect of having an engine failure and no place to go. I'm a person, I like lots of options. So I may come back a different time and have a little bit more capable airplane, maybe one that has another engine.
John.
Or two or three more.
two or three more engines, you're saying?
Yeah.
But I think the whole key to a long distance trip like this, you know, we're talking 800 to 1,000 miles, is being flexible and not boxing yourself into, I'm doing one route and one route only, because then it's get there-itis because you don't have any more options, you know? So it's starting out, probably the first decision you're going to make is Abbotsford right after you clear customs, and you're going to take it into small bites and, okay, I'm going to go to the next airport, stop, and just keep going and see how it goes. And it may mean backtracking. And it very probably will extend into a multi-day trip because you're going to get stuck somewhere and you might have to wait it out. You know, David alluded to it's probably an overnight trip. If you're looking at 11 hours of flying in one day, the fatigue factor is really going to get in that too. So this could be a week-long trip and you're just going to have to keep making it up as you're going along.
Well, I got to challenge that a little bit, John, about, you know, one airport to another, which is, you know, a strategy that we use in the lower 48 all the time to make our way across the country because we've got so many airports and so many ways to go a little bit further north, now a little south, and now north, and now a little bit more north. But once you pass that where Prince George is there, you're pretty much going to commit to one of the routes, of the inland routes, and you're going to have to backtrack a long way to be able to go to another. And as David pointed out, crossing between them is not trivial. It takes you over some really uninhabited areas where if anything happens, you're history.
Yeah.
So,
but I guess the point is that it may not be airport to airport, but it's being flexible and being willing to either wait out or backtrack.
David.
Yeah, I think that point's really important is, you know, you really have to be careful about task completion bias when you're flying in this country. And so you're not going to Juneau, you're going to the next airport. I think that's a really important mindset to have. One thing that wasn't raised for the fuel stop in Port Hardy, the weather isn't great in Port Hardy, which is quite common with a low marine stratus in the morning. And along the coast as well, it's likely there'll be stratus clouds from the outflow winds. And so if you bring fuel, you might not actually be able to get to one of the small number of airports that are available, especially if you're in the earlier part of the day. So that is a strategy, but I think you need to be careful about what the weather is. And it speaks to the problem is that a lot of times you don't know because there's going to be great big gaps in the weather reporting. And I've certainly had that where it's been beautiful when I left, at the place I left, beautiful where I'm going, and there was a big plug of quite ugly weather in the middle that wasn't obvious to any of the forecasting products.
Paul?
David, this is a question for you, and it relates to that task focus. So you've got a number of airports along the way, which may be good bolt holes, but no fuel. So that, in some ways, doesn't do you much good. Is fuel flown into those airports if you need it, and what does that cost?
Well, what's happened is, unfortunately, 20 years ago, there was a lot more fuel available. Most of these airports had fuel, but the day VFR piston stuff's pretty much gone away except for float planes. And so now it's mostly helicopters and they're all turbine. So they all have Jet A, but they won't have 100 low lead. So yeah, you would probably have to get it flown in and it would be huge money. Prince Rupert does have a float plane base. But there's a ferry to get to the airport, and it's fuel is dangerous goods, and it's like a huge deal to get any fuel brought over in liquid form. So if your plan works, great. If it doesn't work, your challenges are going to multiply in a pretty exponential way, which I think is a common problem in the States or in this area. It goes from, you know, all is good to a very difficult solution to resolve as a binary. There's no kind of middle ones. It's either really good or really bad. And this is an example with fuel. The other thing it is important is if you look at the weather, any water is going to be quite rough because my previous career in Canada's Navy as a ship's officer, I spent a lot of time up there. Queen Charlotte Strait is quite shallow. With the strong winds, there'll be a huge swell. And the shoreline is vertical rock. Like if you wind up there, you're not going to survive. That's the bottom line. And so that's 3 hours of that, which just doesn't work for me. But, I don't want to minimize the fact that it is absolutely spectacular. So, but if you do want to accept that risk, you must do it with a really clear malice aforethought, where you really have thought through the options and you have some idea of what options you have and are willing to accept long periods where there are no options. And I can't, I have an opinion on that, but ultimately it's going to be the pilot in command's choice.
Dave.
One other piece of essential equipment, a siphon hose. I was landed at remote airports in this region where there was no, the fuel pump was broken, truck was down, you can't get fuel. But the siphon hose allowed me to buy some gas off of a guy with a beaver whose airplane was there. And so it's like, I was just in a Cantabria. I just needed 10 gallons to get to the next town, And so, a siphon hose kind of saved the day that I had one, was able to transfer fuel. I know you covered this in a different scenario, but non-ethanol car gas is often available on this route where avgas isn't. So, just a couple of information points to put in the stew.
Just add a little bit of gas to the whole thing. There's nothing special you need for the fuel bladder in the airplane. Is that something that's relatively easy to carry? Is there no permits required or anything like that, Dave?
Yeah, and these things are brilliant. The one that I have I bought it at a military surplus store. It's for a ground vehicle, but it rolls up flat. It takes almost no space when you're not using it. When you do use it, you put 10 gallons in And when you want to put it in the airplane, you just put it on top of the wing, you open the spigot, and it pours right in. So it's like whoever thought of this was really using their bean. And these things are great to have, and they can really save the day in a pinch.
It sounds like uncertainty, particularly around the weather, is one of the biggest issues, and the lack of specific reporting points. As you said, David, we're used to having so many reporting points in the lower 48 here that, to have hundreds of miles with no weather at all to tell you that something's going on there is an issue. You said that there are no weather products that really give you that information. But, I'm wondering about stuff like windy.com and that give you model data in a really graphical format, because we even use that around here just for where airports are not that far apart. And it's been surprisingly accurate. Is that making any entry up there? And I'll put the same question to you in a second, JP, as to what this potential value of that would be and, potential drawbacks. So to you, David, first.
I think the challenge is that because the terrain is quite mountainous and you have a marine influence and then the land-based influences, there's a lot of micro weather that happens that my experience has been it just isn't captured. So yeah, as a general flow, and especially the higher altitudes, like once you get into like 12,000, it's all pretty good. But if you're down in the valley or, along the coast or whatever, you get quite variable weather that I personally haven't seen captured. And windy, I will say, is quite good on the coast. But once you get inland, my experience has been less favorable. I think they are. It's getting better all the time. But I would be cautious about putting my faith in it, particularly in those kind of middle of the province routes and kind of the Yukon routes as well. I mean, ultimately, the data's got to come from somewhere, right? The model's got to be populated with data. The more data, the better you get.
Yeah. And so what do you think about that, JP? Because you really are being able to look at the model data and, the model is built on information it got. So it's theoretically taking into account major mountain ranges and valleys and bodies of water, that fold back in, and it gets improved all the time. And I feel like this is important because it is used for, it's not just useful for flying up in Canada and Alaska. I mean, it's useful for all sorts of situations where you don't have a specific point forecast like a TAF to work with. So what do you think, JP? What are the advantages there, and what are the traps that you might fall into?
Well, I think the model gives you some data that you wouldn't already have. I think it's critical that if you're looking at this kind of information, you make sure you're looking at the higher resolution models like a 3-kilometer HRRR. But I think one of the issues is going to be for those models to initialize correctly. The more data, the better. And there are not the balloon releases or the surface obs to be ingested into these models in some of these more remote areas. So I would use caution, especially if you're trying to use this model kind of almost in a way to give yourself some sort of TAF or some kind of pseudo virtual surface ob, because there are going to be a lot of micro scale effects because of terrain influences and so forth. The models take that in, but the models also have limited resolution, at least at this point. The more resolution you give a model, the noisier it gets. So I think that's going to be a big, big issue with this. It's better than no data, but also it could lead you a little astray if you count on this too much.
And do you think there's, one thing I've noticed with these, they provide such, precision in terms of, the ceiling will be here, the rain will be here, that kind of thing, where, is there a danger of, being drawn in and a perception of a kind of accuracy that really isn't there, even though you're seeing the same kind of data, the same kind of presentation. Here there's more data, up there there's less, so there's less going into it.
Yeah, I think it needs to be taken with context. I always say in the meteorology world, we would say it's guidance, not the gospel. And I think a lot of times with these tools that people have now on their mobile devices, they look at it and it's like, this is the way it's going to be. This is the way it looks on this particular map. But in reality, it doesn't quite turn out that way, or whatever weather feature is 10 or 15 miles off. And, you know, on your particular trip, that could make a big difference. So, yeah, we're not there yet in being able to really replace those surface obs and really the human hand at giving us more accurate meteorology data. It's getting there, but not there yet.
You know, one thing people are talking about a lot in this discussion is a more capable airplane. And pretty much everyone has talked about that except you, David, who said this is a perfectly capable airplane, a 172, for doing this. People want a more capable airplane maybe for the coastal route. Obviously, another engine provides a certain redundancy in terms of having an engine, but it's also burning more fuel. So it's really, you know, just couching against one thing. What do we mean by a more capable airplane? When people have said that, like John, you even said, I'd like a more capable airplane, maybe another engine or two or three or four. What makes an airplane more capable with these kind of long range trips? Are you just, is it about speed? Is it about altitude? Is it, you know, we have a number of people who, you know, they're only flying single engine. Is that single engine just out for a lot of you on the coast? Or is it just about if you're flying faster, then the headwinds won't make as big a difference? David, then Captain. David. You
know, speed is a huge deal. I was flying a Piper Aerostar as a bird dog or lead plane for forest fire suppression operations, and I was going to Watson Lake to join up with the tanker, and it was quite similar weather, and I got halfway up the trench, and it was just a plug full of goop. So I turned around, went down up the eastern arm of the Williston Lake, looped around the east side, up through by Fort Nelson, and then over to Watson Lake. But I had a 900-mile range of fuel. I had 900 miles of fuel, worth of fuel, and the airplane did 200 knots. So it was annoying, but it wasn't a huge deal. And I had two engines, right? Yeah. And so that speed gave me a lot of options to go someplace else. If you're in a 110-knot airplane, you know, and the where you can physically go, the number of miles you can go is a lot less, and the places you need to go are always going to be further away. So I think speed's a big piece. The single engine versus twin engine, I think ultimately that's personal. Like, I would never do that flight in a single engine airplane, full stop. But lots of people do. Like Catherine's Bonanza, like that strikes me as, you know, a pretty capable airplane, especially if got fuel in Port Hardy. They could go all the way to Ketchikan and all the way back with what's in the tanks. And so I think if you're okay with the fact the airplane has to run, then that's, I would say, not unreasonable. But when you're in a slow airplane, you really have to think about how far can I go in terms of miles with the gas I have? And then where are my options? And when you start putting the two together, you'll often find you have very few options. And if you haven't thought about that ahead of time, then that's how you get into trouble. And my last comment was, a couple of years ago, a Cessna 170 crashed 10 miles short of Bellingham in the water. The airplane and pilot were never recovered. He was on a direct flight from Ketchikan to Bellingham.
Wow.
And so the approach, it was through, because of the Vancouver control zone, he came out over the water, which is kind of a typical way. It's very hard to get through the land route through Vancouver International. So he did what would normally happen is you fly down the east side of Vancouver Island, then cut over to Bellingham, and ran out of gas 10 miles from Bellingham, which is over the water. So there's a sad, long history of those kind of accidents. There's five airplanes within, I think, 10 miles of Watson Lake, all tried to come up the trench and didn't quite make it.
Within 10 miles of Watson Lake, just because of there was no other option than to try and run it on fumes where they were landing off airport.
Yeah. And yeah, over the last, you know, 40, 50 years. But I saw a stat that potentially there's 40 airplanes in the Yukon and British Columbia since 1950 that either have never been found or were found months, years later by accident. Right. So they effectively disappeared on the day of the flight.
You know, you're not making this like a really strong sell at this point for making these flights. And this is on Catherine's bucket list. We don't want to end this conversation in any way discouraging Catherine from going. You might be doing this someday in Nikki and your Bonanza. What do you say to that question about what's the right airplane to do something like this?
Yeah, certainly when your question was about capability and both a more powerful engine gives you generally a faster cruise speed, and it also gives you the opportunity to fly higher if you need to. So, you know, on a cheerier note, if I make it, I'm going to have the most amazing photos by the time I get to Alaska. So, yeah, I would do this in Nikki. Nikki is my Bonanza. And, you know, part of it is not just to do this trip, but, you know, I consider my airplanes family. You know, Wilbur and Nikki are my family. And part of it is the adventure of doing it in my own airplane, which I think would be just capable enough to do this flight. So, you know, I'm looking forward to it.
Dave.
Yeah, you know, I confess to being an airplane snob, and I've done this trip in airplanes ranging from a Citabria to a multi-engine crewed turbojet, you know, so it's like, and the experiences are totally different. You know, I did this route Bellingham to Ketchikan this summer in a single engine airplane. And I've got to say that it was one of the most, you know, in terms of scenery, in terms of everything good and amazing. You know, we flew the Inner Passage, we flew the Outer Coast. It was totally spectacular, and you know, it can be done in a safe and sane way. And I would just encourage people to take a hard look at it. But on a day like the scenario day, where it's got the best weather of any route, hands down, that would be the way that I would want to go, regardless of the, you know, whether a plane had de-icing equipment or a parachute or any other sort of safety equipment. That's the way to. That's the weather is the biggest risk. That's the way to go,
David.
As I understand, Catherine, your other airplane's a 152. Would you take that airplane?
I'd probably take Nikki first, but I probably would do it in Wilbur, yeah.
And the reason I'm asking is because one summer I was based in Watson Lake, and my wife's airplane is a Grumman AA-1, right? So basically a 150. And she did Route 5 in one day. The weather was quite a bit better than this forecast, but not, well, there wasn't the low cloud. I mean, there was a little bit of cloud over Fort Nelson, but it was not quite as bad. And had a great trip, kind of hopscotched along 200 miles at a time. And so you can get to Alaska in a pretty basic airplane safely, I guess is really the message I would like to leave. But the more basic the airplane, the more important it is that you're very careful about how you plan your route and you keep your options open.
You know, I think that's a great point, and it makes a great ending point to this discussion. But I have to put in one more thing while we have the tape running here, as it were, which is, if this is on people's bucket list, fuel bladder is something to add for the people who've done it before, the people who are considering around the table. Anything else that you should pack into that airplane? What else should you take or have on speed dial on your phone or look at in just these last minutes? Anything else that's really important to bring along besides some extra fuel, Dave?
Passport, siphon hose.
Passport, siphon hose, fuel bladder, David.
Garmin InReach, a spot. Mm-hmm. Like you are insane not to have that these days.
Right.
Because, and ideally a sat phone is really the 100% solution. But a GPS locator, absolutely required. And plan to be able to camp out. So bring tents and all the appropriate other stuff. And also bring spares for your airplane. So like a couple of spark plugs. If you're going to be doing some gravel stuff, you know, I would strongly consider a tube for the nose wheel and the main wheel, because that may be the difference between getting out of some place or being stuck for a long time. But so, yeah, so, be prepared, like, you know, be the good Boy Scout. We made this scenario go to Juneau, but, you know, if the pilot was going to do this, then he would be crazy to come straight back. Like, once you're up there, you know, don't come right back. There's so much cool spots to go, and vice versa. And like, if you're just going to Fairbanks, do look at the option of jumping over to the Southeast Coast if the weather's good.
Well, I think the it was sort of implied in the intro, you know, if you get to Juneau, then your buddy who's up there will then give you the tour of Alaska with two people. And that's other things we could have talked about in here in terms of like bringing people with you so you're not all alone on this route. But the thing that every time I think about or have discussions like this is really just, like was said earlier on, to focus about the journey. And it's almost like the farther afield you go from the familiar flying you do, the more you need to shift your focus to just the next airport, the next few tasks, and the view that's out the window, and be less invested in what your ultimate destination would really be.